I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
I have to admit, I suffer from being too literal. While I enjoy abstract or unfamiliar art, it often takes me a while to warm up and get into the right headspace. While never impenetrable, I do find the broad difference in cultures between American or Western sensibilities and Eastern, in this case Japanese, aesthetics can make it tough to find a way in. I feel like a lot of the preparation reading for this episode helped to give me a vocabulary and a useful perspective where I now get a lot more out of these films. And I can hope we might serve the same purpose to the listener, deepening interest and making it a little easier to access some of these stories. This episode will be part one, and we'll be talking about the movie House, or Houseu, from 1977, some history, and other movies and pieces along the way. Next episode, we'll be talking about some of the more mainstream films that come out of Japan in the last two decades. So, Mindy, you've got some history of Japan.
Yeah, it was something very similar to the films where I just didn't really think about, like, the history of Japan. It's not something you really learn about in school here in America.
No, we get a very singular sort of, this was our relationship in World War II,
right,
and we don't talk about them anymore.
Yeah, and it's like they never existed before World War II.
Right.
Like, we have no clue. But huge, huge history, obviously, like anybody. The first kind of pottery where we know people were there in Japan was 14,000 BC. And Japan can thank the end of the glacial period for being its own little group of islands, because the end of the glacial period separated it from the rest of Asia. So hooray for Japan's freedom from glacial ice.
In the, I don't remember specifically, but their relationship with China is a tenuous one, and it almost seems like they were trying to get some of it back.
You know what's interesting, though, is for a very long time, they actually had a great relationship with China and with the Three Kingdoms of Korea, and they had a great sharing of culture, technology. Japan started out as multiple kingdoms, and when China first writes about Japan, which in pretty old text, there was hundreds of kingdoms is how they describe the islands of Japan, and then they kind of came together forming this emperor kind of situation that still exists today in some extent. We have the shogun idea of government as well coming up. This is all kind of existing, but the emperor that we still have kind of today is from the tradition from when it first started.
And that, like, original lineage, right? Because this is all sort of, you're born into it, not dissimilar to, like, you know, monarchy in England.
Yeah, and we're talking first century.
Wow.
So this has been for a really long time, and it was similar to England it's similar to modern England in that the monarchy has money, but not exactly power.
Okay.
That they were just the figurehead, and they got along great, the Three Kingdoms of Korea, China, everything was really, really coming along. Korea is actually who brings Buddhism to Japan.
Oh.
And that's been in Japan since 538 AD.
Wow.
And it's equally been side by side with Shinto and Buddhism all coexisting just fine on the islands. Isn't that amazing how that works? In the Nara period, that's like 700s, a quarter of the population of Japan is wiped out due to smallpox and huge. It was just a bad set of years. There was earthquakes, wildfires, which then made famine. There was a tsunami. It was bad time. So a quarter of the population is totally wiped out. And they're then regrowing. And during the next couple of hundreds of years, we have a real influx of immigration. And so what Japan is made of then around like 1100 and on into the 1400s is just immigration, constant moving of people like that. The first Europeans don't come into Japan until 1543. There had never been a European in Japan.
Wow, 1543. Okay.
It's very late. And they only got there by accident because they were trying to go to China and a storm rerouted them.
Oh, all right. That's okay. I guess not. Not too different from, like, Columbus not looking for America
exactly.
at all. Yeah.
But 1543 is relatively late, I think, in in that. And so what then you have right after that, of course, they go home and tell everybody about this awesome place. And now Christianity has gotten involved and all the things that Europe brings with it. This ushers in the Edo period, which is one of the best periods in Japan as far as prosperity. If you're an insider, if you're an outsider, Edo period is not for you, because with this influx of European, liking to tell you what to do kind of mentality that was existing in the mid-1500s, Christianity becomes outlawed in 1638. None of that anymore in Japan.
Outlawed. Wow.
And the borders start to close. Starts off slowly at first, but then if you leave Japan, you cannot come back. And it entirely closes off. And the Edo period is what we know for great Japanese literature, art, storytelling. It becomes this very closed and isolated place then. Not even China or Korea coming in. They're still allowed to trade. There's an island off of Japan that the Dutch, only the Dutch, China and Korea can trade with them. But that's it. No books are brought into the main parts of the islands where everyone's living. Nothing. So Japan is made to make their own art. And that's when we first start hearing about kind of these folk religions, this folk telling of the stories, and some of the beginnings of Japanese horror. The Edo period goes into the Meiji period, which ends pretty abruptly. 1853, Matthew Perry from the U.S., but not from France, comes over and forces Japan to quit being isolated because he has gunships and Japan can't do shit.
Could you be any more closed?
It was not good for Japan. And Japan essentially has to say, like, okay, guys, I guess. Because the U.S. is like, I want to play with you. And Japan's like, I don't want to play with anybody.
Yeah. And they're like, but we brought money. And they're like, all right, come in.
One of the main kind of ghosts or spirit things that we hear about in Japanese horror, Japanese literature, actually is from the combination of when Japan and China were close and when they all shared their history and their technology with each other. The yokai, which is kind of the biggest Japanese ghost that we would know about, is actually first mentioned in first century Chinese literature. But it's a Japanese ideal that China kind of glommed onto.
When they were still accepting outside ideas.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's a ghost, and they usually look like animals, and I don't know, it kind of strikes to my ear, obviously, Princess Mononoke. A Mononoke is a spirit-like being, but they were never a person. So it's good to think about Japanese ghosts, which differ some to Chinese ghosts. A lot of times, your Chinese ghost was a person. There's, like, Chinese spirit and Chinese ghost that was a person. In Japan, it's not really that they ever were a person. It's that they're this, like, other thing that always was other.
Right. If memory serves, like, Shintoism, there's, like, a spirit of the woods and different, like, sometimes inanimate objects still have their own sort of ghostly spirit.
Yeah, and they're all part of this yokai kind of idea.
In doing research for this episode, I found an old PBS channel clip of Shozo Sato, a renowned Japanese teacher of kabuki and Zen art, where he talks about Japanese aesthetics. He talks about the emphasis on stylization versus authenticity.
Why Japanese artists for generations, for 2,000 years, they don't think about realism? The artists question themselves, what is the function of art in our society? In our life, you know, without having this answer, clear answer, artists are not practicing art properly. Artists practicing art as self-satisfactions. If one knows what the function of art is, then should open to the public, invite the public to sharing the art with others. And art can ease one's pain on your souls and minds. One can give the great stimulus, the energy to fight against so-called bitter reality. For the so-called general public, this maximum art, where there is richness, they come into this atmosphere to enjoy for a moment. Persons who are intellectual, they go into minimal art. So where they can emphasize their intellectual level of purity. And that's how Japanese have enjoyed this minimal and maximum art for centuries. That's the major difference between Western aesthetic and Japanese.
He also describes maximum art, such as kabuki, and minimal art, and then the need for balance in both.
To make this art form that can be theater, painting, literature, landscape design, architecture, any type of art that you can think of, to make this richest possible, I usually call maximum art of Japan. The artists of that period and the subject in general try to feed in whatever he or she needs to make this art form richest possible by this element in that color, this texture, this sound, etc., etc. If the artist misjudge the quality and the quantity by adding one more element, then this box shatters. So then kabuki theater is, in this example, that trying to make that theater and the theatrical experience rich as possible in every meaning, sound, colors, action, and actually music and vocalization is in the category of sound, and then motion, movement. All that visual is going to the maximum richness. Now, on minimal art, it's same concept of a cube. And then from this little opening, withdraw of any unnecessary materials that artists decided to make it to the purest possible, minimum is possible. So then the box is start caving in. You may have heard of no drama, or haiku poetry, or rock garden, and a tea room, any of this architecture, landscape, and literature, and then painting, black ink paintings, are in category of this minimal art.
When I hear maximum art, now I think of movies like Shinja Tsukamoto's Tetsuo the Iron Man, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but also movies like Takashi Miike's Ichi the Killer. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, he also directed Audition, an example of minimal art that Faculty of Horror recently did a whole episode on. But yeah, the sort of maximum art speaks to like the like overabundant visuals, mm-hmm, and the sort of saturated, lush aesthetic that we get in Houssou.
Right. And it is too much. And the way he describes it is excellent, though, in that for the intellectuals, they'll go for the minimalism. And the maximalism is for kind of the populace, the general population.
Yeah. And I think a really good example of that is that Houssou was well received in the theater. Like, it did well. Mm-hmm. Critically, it was a bomb. Like,
yeah.
There wasn't it did not go over well in among the intelligentsia.
I like then that I didn't like it. I feel better about myself.
I've got a little bit on Toho Studio. With a history that spans more than 100 years, Japan has one of the oldest and largest film industries in the world. And Toho Studio is like the oldest surviving grandfather. Japan's largest film studio has been around since 1932, and it's mostly recognized as the home of Godzilla and any number of kaiju movies. However, they also produce the films of Akira Kurosawa, and they still theatrically distribute most of Studio Ghibli's animated movies. If one is to believe the internet, the Toho Studio wanted to go after the success of Steven Spielberg's Jaws that broke box office records in 1975, so they approached Nobuhiko Obayashi to develop a similar script. It's such a strange trajectory to think that their goal was to make their own version of Jaws, and they arrived
at this House. Is what they got.
Yeah.
Like, I read that too, and I said, I don't believe this. But then when Obayashi describes how he comes up with this story, oh, you asked your daughter who was like 10 or 11 years old. Then I said, yes, I actually get it now. This is much like the imagination of a 10-year-old.
Yeah, and I kind of dug that. There's a description, and these are her words. Adults only think about things they understand. Everything stays on that boring human level, while children can come up with things that can't be explained. Several of Chigumi, that was her name, her ideas made it into the movie, such as the reflection in the mirror attacking the viewer, the watermelon being pulled from the well, then appearing like a human head, and the piano that goes after melody. But we'll get into those details.
Yeah.
So written and directed by Nobuhiko Obayashi, this movie took a little while to get off the ground, because after the studio approached Obayashi for the script, it took 2 years before the studio could... No one wanted to direct this movie.
I mean, you can't blame them.
But like, a job is a job.
Successful was just absurd. A job is a job. Is it, though?
Well, in this case... So he wanted the job for himself so much that he... Like, over those 2 years, he made a short movie. His background was in, like, television commercials and sort of smaller features. But this was his first feature film that he fought for to get made. And... It's definitely a passion project. Like, there is so much in this movie that it was clearly, yeah, like the total sum of a tremendous amount of work. You weren't so big a
fan
of this one.
Yeah, just because you try really hard, like, let's be honest, you don't always get the prize. Just because you tried really hard. Or else our presidency would be different, right? So it just doesn't always work out like that. I don't know. The thing that struck me in the very beginning was the music. And the music was released, completely done and released, like 2 years before the film even came out.
Yeah, it's a weird way to, like,
which makes sense why it doesn't
momentum.
Go with the film, really.
It's very Western, the music, mm-hmm. isn't it?
There's two separate composers. You can clearly hear the difference. It starts off with the zany kind of 20th century kind of experimental sounding music. And at first I'm like, yeah. And then it goes south really quick. We have Asahi Kobayashi and Miki Yoshino, and there's then a little band cameo in there.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they harass the girls at the train station.
Yeah, yeah. And then they sing, yeah, this weird Western doo-wop kind of song.
Let's give them a synopsis if we can. The plot follows Gorgeous, a young schoolgirl, and her six classmates on their summer vacation. They travel to her aunt's country home, which then tries to devour the girls in bizarre ways.
Yeah, that's pretty much the plot.
Did you have a favorite of the girls? I'll give you a refresher of their names.
Oh, I don't need a refresher. I remember each one of them. I found myself liking Kung Fu and Mac, obviously, because I feel I would be Mac.
You're always hungry.
I'm always hungry and I'm always eating. And everything I think about revolves around food.
I thought Mac might have had a tapeworm. Like, she was insatiable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I liked that, but I really liked Kung Fu. And there was a point I was watching and Jackson goes, is this racist? And I was like, no, everyone's Japanese. I don't think it is. I don't know.
Yeah. There were elements that, not being overly familiar, like, in the first part of those character introductions, like, they're at school and, like, I look at them and I'm thinking, like, okay, schoolgirl outfit, that is identical to what Chun-Li in Street Fighter 2 wears.
Well, I didn't
realize that
Sailor
was like
Moon.
A national. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, why is she dressed up like Sailor Moon?
Yeah. It's just formal school attire.
Yeah. It's just the way it is.
But so the girls, I've mentioned Gorgeous. You mentioned Kung Fu and Mac. Mm-hmm. There's also Prof, short for a professor. She's the nerdy one.
Yes.
Fantasy, which I'm guessing she daydreams a bunch. I was a little unclear.
I don't know.
And also Mac. Mac sounds the most American, and I thought maybe that's almost like a jab at Americans as far as, like, yeah, you're always eating, like, you fat Americans. But this is 77. This is before, like, we had a reputation for obesity.
Yeah, so I don't know where that Mac. I don't know. Maybe it means something.
Yeah.
Like in Japanese that I don't understand.
Yeah. Listeners, if you're hearing this and you're familiar with Japanese culture, let us know why Mac is Mac. I made mac and cheese. Is that no?
McDonald's.
McDonald's. That's totally it. That's totally it. You just figured it out. And Melody. Oh, Melody and Sweet are the two. I don't remember Sweet at all, I don't think. But Melody is the musician. That's easy enough. But yeah. They're named, I mean, they're kind of these really generic archetypes, which I think, yes, it speaks to being written by, like, middle-aged men, but it's also kind of like, it's almost video gamey as far
Definitely.
As stripping down character to single adjectives. But at the same time, it also serves as like a fairy tale, which this story very much kind of works that way.
So originally the girls were not going to go all together on this vacation, but Gorgeous is mad because her father has married a new lady and that's going to be her new mom.
And just kind of like surprises her. Yeah. It's like, hey, meet your new mom.
And Gorgeous does not like that. So Gorgeous writes her aunt that she's only ever seen one time in her whole life and says, hey, I'd like to bring six friends and hang out with you all summer. And aunt, who's only ever met Gorgeous once, says, sure, come on. And then they all go. And that's how this whole thing like starts off, and it's so bizarre.
Yeah, and she shares with her girlfriends the story of her aunt and the idea that her aunt's fiancé had to go off to war. It was the Great War. And he died there while she was the sort of like waiting bride at home. And so it was like heartbroken. And
doesn't say that he died, just says he didn't come back.
Right. He might have made a judgment call. He's like, this is my opportunity to skedaddle.
It turns out the aunt's a bitch. It seems like he made the right decision.
As it turns out. And so this kind of lays the groundwork for how this kind of becomes a gothic horror at its core, in terms of this, like, you know, this this heartbroken bride who then sort of feeds on the souls of young unmarried women
locked up in her big house. There's things that I enjoyed about it. I love the flashbacks, actually. Those were really, really nice. And the way they were presented as photo and then moving photo was really lovely. There's an inexplicable cat. At first, it's inexplicable, I guess, but it's a cat named Blanche, and I liked that part of it.
I like that, yeah.
I like the cat. There's also Mr. Togo. Did that bother you?
So this movie is labeled as a horror comedy, and Mr. Togo is definitely the comedy component.
But they said he's supposed to be handsome and manly, and I disagree with that. These are like young girls.
He's clumsy and silly as far as we're concerned.
Really silly.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That actor, it turns out, was a country music star in Japan and also served as a voice on the Japanese version of Thomas the Tank. He played Two Feathers. I guess no relation to Two Chains.
The way that the editing is done in this film gives me such great anxiety, which was part of, I think, why I disliked it.
Okay.
For a long time, I thought we were on like the arrival time. Like it was non-linear, and I didn't understand
the
if
movie
time
arrival.
Was. Yeah. The movie, The Arrival. And I thought, is time moving forward or? I was so confused. It is just moving forward. It's just very fucking confusing.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess within scenes, they do play with like when things sort of become more and more chaotic. There's a lot of like forward motion and then backwards motion. And there's a lot of sort of swinging pendulum as far as what we're seeing. And also to speak to like the visuals on screen, I did start to like it. I'll give you, it took about 40 minutes into the movie before I really cared about anything I was seeing.
Yeah.
And I think that's just like sort of me slowly acclimating again. Like, you know, this might be one of the genres or subgenres of horror that I know least about. And so I was trying to sort of figure out what was going on.
Right.
Second viewing helped a lot.
Okay.
And that's actually
that's
the
that
second
thing
view
about
is
watching
why
things again.
Yeah. And I'll do it for movies that are going to be on the podcast, but like movies I just peripherally hate, I'm never going back. But in this case, like it was worth going back. I did get more out of it. That said, like some of the visuals can be pretty crude. Like these were, I don't know if they were rudimentary special effects, but they do come off that way at times. Like there's some pretty rough green screen, but there's also like sort of fun. There are a couple visuals that are purposefully manufactured. I think the train stations have like a funny platform background that our characters...
I will say the background paintings are actually pretty amazing. I mean, they're not like...
Pop art-y.
Yeah, I mean, they're not like the stuff coming out of England in the 60s that was earlier and much better and beautiful, more beautiful, but it's still like so vibrant, the color.
Yeah.
It's actually really pretty paintings that they're acting in front of.
Yeah. And there's a lot of like animation over the film, mm-hmm. which I haven't seen much of. It's kind of, you know, Disney and sort of the like Peach Dragon kind of era did it very well. This is seemingly like much more purposefully kitsch. Like this is kind of pop art overlaid.
It reminded me of those Beatles movies, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. Yellow Submarine.
Because there was some like stopping the film, going forward, going backwards, like speeding it up. That really reminded me of some of the Beatles films. And certain points, the music makes it seem like it might become a musical at any time. And then it just disappoints you.
So those components lend to this sort of like playful sensibility of the movie, and in intercut with those there's occasional like eerie moments, and I like that. Mm-hmm. Like the aunt before she goes full nuts is kind of, you know, is creeping out the girls here and there, and I dug that. I thought it was
the eyeball
nice
mouth.
And
yeah. It was amazing. That was great. Let's go back to Blanche though, because I really can't get enough of this fucking cat.
Blanche the cat.
This cat is so important to them. Firstly, she was going to leave him because it didn't make it onto the train. So she was like, sorry, Blanche, I don't know where you are. I'm going to just leave. And then the cat makes it onto the train. Then they get off of the train and they seemingly have to walk for miles and miles to go to this watermelon stand, as it turns out.
Remote mansion on the hill with a watermelon stand at the bottom of the
hill. He's like the only one there. But they, at one point in time, literally asked the cat where they should go. The cat meows back to them and they're like, okay, I'm not going to trust a cat to tell me where to go.
Right, but if this was a Studio Ghibli movie, it's par for the course.
Well, and they talk about the cat being magic, but they're like, you know, which way should we go? And the cat's like, meow, and a great idea, Blanche, bye.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, all this makes a lot more sense if you thought of it as, like, an animated film, which parts are.
Yeah. I guess that makes you feel a little bit better.
It makes me feel better. You, not so much. You still don't like this.
No, I just can't get behind it. It's too much. It's too absurd.
It really is nutty. I don't know if I'm trying to make it make sense for the listener, but I think it deserves a look just as this like sort of cultural cornerstone as far as Japanese horror that's also
funny.
Yeah, and like decidedly modern. At the time this came out, it was unique, like as far as the psychedelic aesthetic coming out of England and sort of animated films of the time. This is still kind of, it feels like Japanese style evolving into film and then incorporating like greater elements. Yeah, I don't know. I thought the aesthetics were cool. I thought it was a pretty neat looking film.
It does look neat. I liked also the cat sing along. That was an excellent part when the cat starts singing. Then there's like a whole scene about the cat singing. I literally wrote, this montage with the cat singing is maybe the best ever. And I think I'll stand by that.
Well, when you said that, you threw me off. When you said the cat singing, I thought like, do re mi fa so, like saying,
like word. People words?
Like, yeah.
No.
But no, it was meowing. It was,
yeah, cats can't do solfege, Darren. Don't be stupid. This isn't the Aristocats.
In a review I read online, someone described Houssou as an episode of Scooby-Doo if directed by Mario Bava.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's a fun way to describe it. Perhaps an even stranger film, and I've got some descriptions to throw your way. Let me know if any of these stick.
Okay, all right.
Tetsuo the Iron Man. It's like if David Cronenberg, in the era of Crash, tried to remake Darren Aronofsky's Pi.
No. I thought about it. I considered it, but no.
Okay. A Japanese eraser head made with a manga cyberpunk aesthetic.
That's pretty accurate. Eraser head is actually, yeah, it's a very similar aesthetic.
Okay, so we're talking about Tetsuo the Iron Man by Shinja Tsukamoto, with music by Chu Ishikawa. And I think the music is probably the only place you're going to say nice things about this movie.
Yeah. You know, this was, at first I thought it was really cool, right? Look, I mean, like, no. First meaning like the first 15 minutes.
Okay. I'm impressed.
I was like, yes, that's great.
That much.
Awesome. Because the music is so cool and the aesthetic is cool. And then eventually you're just like, I get it. And now there's still like 45 minutes left.
Right. Do something else.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I'm obsessed with the music of this. It's like a big music video.
Yeah. It's like a long, there's so little dialogue. It does get to play with just purely the visuals and the music for the vast majority of the film.
Yeah. And so that part I really, really like. The whole cyberpunk aesthetic is so cool. And I wanted to look into it a little bit more because beyond it just being cool, I wanted to kind of understand where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's best to, and it helps you kind of with the rest of the film as well, it's best to think of it as a work of Dadaism because cyberpunk comes out of Dadaist art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we really need to think about it in that way. The punk part being the nihilistic thing, but the cyber part and the industrial part comes out of found or current technology.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
exactly.
As far as what we're seeing on screen.
Yeah, because I'm not talking about like urinal Dadaism. I'm talking about, you know, what's found today, which would be computers, which is everyday life. And so it's great to think about the nonsense aspect of Dadaism and put it into this. It's much easier and more palatable, I think.
Here's a brief synopsis for Tetsuo the Iron Man. A businessman accidentally kills the metal fetishist, who gets his revenge by slowly turning the man into a grotesque hybrid of flesh and rusty metal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. That's pretty basic, yeah.
Now, the filmmaker Tsukamoto talked about his sort of growing disgust with Tokyo, and I mean, this was 87, probably came out in 88. 88, 89, it seems like the internet, conflicting reports. But the Tokyo that we imagine in 1988 must have been like the beginning trends of just the integration of technology. And I could see a sort of like reactionary punk sort of, well, reaction to that. And the movie kind of works in that sense, as far as like the integration of technology and man and this sort of like scrap approach to it all. Yeah, I don't know. It's ultimately an art film. Like it looks,
yes.
It's like stark black and white. It was filmed in 16mm black and white film. And so it's got grit and there's a lot of like fast motion camera tricks that, you know, this harkens back to like when I was helping friends make movies in their film classes in San Francisco that like, you know, sort of one frame at a time, slow moving that when you add it all together, it gives you this like sort of spastic, fast motion mm-hmm. film. And there's a lot of that in this film. It's going to be pretty jarring to look at.
Yeah.
It could make you motion sick.
When we were talking about maximalism, this is to the max.
This is saturated. This is, holy shit, this is too much. For black, I mean, can you imagine if this was in color?
Oh, if it was in color, my eyes would just bleed. Like, right? You couldn't even focus. I mean, I think I compare it to nowadays, but now people love fast crap like that, but if you've ever been to one of those Cirque du Soleil shows, there's just shit happening all over. And it's the most, like, overwhelming thing that I've ever been to.
I would watch a Cirque du Soleil production of Tetsuo the Iron Man because I think it would be, yeah, I think half the audience would walk out. I think it would be too fucking crazy.
It's too much. It's just too much. This cyberpunk, like, aesthetic that is going on here and everything is so very gritty and industrial. It's so interesting when you think really the most popular thing at that time that we had seen was 82's Blade Runner giving us this cyberpunk idea. And so to see this version of that is brutal and it's gory and the sound editing is also wow.
Yeah, everything. Yeah, grinding metal is the sort of phase that comes to mind just mm-hmm. as far like between the audio and the visuals. It's just this sort of. And even when we talk about, you know, the Iron Man or machine men and sort of integrating technology into humanhood, like there's no finesse to it. Like these are large scraps and chunks. It's not like he's becoming a robot. he is, it's almost like a metal plague that's taking over him.
Right.
And every, like, sore and legion sprouts another bit of machinery. And yeah, it's pretty unsettling.
But he kind of deserves it. He's a bad guy.
Yeah, he did hit a guy with this car and then try and throw him in the river to get rid of the
exactly.
body.
So, I mean, it's kind of a cautionary tale.
Yeah, and you texted me. I think that might have been the point where it lost you, where his phallus yeah. also evolves after a pretty horrific nightmare, which turns out to be
the truth,
you know, for, yeah, foresight. And then I had to ask you for a clarification or a second opinion, because my takeaway was that his girlfriend, who helped him get rid of the body, essentially kills her.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's it. At that point in time, so I wrote you, there's certain Japanese aesthetics sometimes that come up in films where ladies just can't help but need the D.
Oh, pornographic films.
Yeah.
or like animated
kind
pornographic.
Kind of in lots of things. Like, those ladies just can't help themselves and they're going to do dumb shit that's because of the D. And,
yeah.
and it's kind of happens a lot in Japanese film.
Yeah, even present day.
Yeah,
you've talked about
exactly.
the trifecta of rape zombie films.
Yeah, and
that,
so my
that
thought...
trilogy.
There's four. but my thought on that was that people think this is art, but this is not different than Rape Zombie. That
no.
dramatic scene is just the same as Rape Zombie. So I don't understand why everyone shits on, including you. You won't even watch Rape Zombie, but it's a good time had by all. And this is art,
masochist.
Though. This is fancy, and the other is not fancy. But it's the same shit.
I guess this... I think this gets a little bit of leeway in being made in the late 80s. I don't know. I get it is a difficult sort of position to recognize that, like, you know, these are not feminist films.
No.
These are not particularly fair or considerate to
no.
the female characters in the movies. And so, like, that's something to contend with, certainly. Yeah, there's a reason, you know, this isn't my favorite genre.
Yeah, I liked the ingenuity of it. I'll say that. It made for a great effect, and it made me feel a feeling, because I text you instantly in anger. So it made me feel something, right? Isn't that the idea?
Sure.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners would probably like it. Probably not a lot of our lady listeners.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is... I could see this, like, you would put this on in the background of a party without any of the audio and just sort of let the visuals play, and then people
oh,
would
like,
occasionally
would play
look
in
over.
A bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and,
yeah,
and people would be like,
atmosphere
yes.
for a pretty chaotic night out. I don't know.
Yeah, you're trying to make it happen, and that's okay. Because I know someone's listening to this being like, this is the best movie ever, and Mindy is so wrong.
Oh, so this totally has, like, 77% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
There is no difference between this and Rape Zombie. God
well,
damn it.
Rape Zombie is called Rape Zombie for starters. But,
well, at least it's being honest.
And, you know, I think that 77%, I think it was based on like 14 reviewers. And I think those reviewers are probably dudes.
So we mentioned before about the audio. There's not a lot of talking.
No.
And as our main, he's not a protagonist. He's just a guy.
He's our, we're
I feel
following
nothing
him
for
the
him. The star of the show. The star of the show as he turns more and more metal, but not in the cool, like, Yngwie way, but, like, just metal. He starts to get, like, a robot voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is very cool.
And it's not Ozzy.
And as he loses his humanity, that's when he becomes more and more. This movie is nothing if not just, like, feeding you all the things you want. Right there.
Yeah, there's not really... I mean, there's subtext to the theme, but as far as, like, what we're actually getting on camera, there's not really layers.
No, it is, like, symbolism at its most blunt. Let's talk about the music a little bit.
Okay.
So here's where it gets good. In my opinion, this music is amazing. We said before, Chu Ishikawa is the composer for this film. He's from the band Der Eisenrost, and actually... one of the band members is actually an actor in this film, too.
Oh.
Whatever. Not important. The music's what's important here. He is an industrial artist in this cyberpunk kind of idea. And remember before, I'm going to drop a little theory on you.
Okay.
So you remember before when I talked about punk music using a lot of tritones?
Yes.
Okay. And like hardcore music using a lot of tritones.
Yes. And this played into the sort of bar chords. And so you're never quite sure like what key you're in.
Right. Exactly. We also hear tritones so much in Western scores. For horror film to be, yes, like, ooh, this is eerie and this is whatever.
It's even in your Mindy's Music Corner opening theme.
Can't help but adore her. It's Mindy's Music Corner.
Exactly. Tritones, the best, right? In these films, in these cyberpunk films, even something like Terminator, they're using modes and they're really sticking to two modes. They're sticking with Phrygian mode in Aeolian mode. So it's interesting. They're using this, which is Western-based music, whatever. We know the Phrygian mode from the Terminator theme. It uses similar aural thing. And what you get is 1 flat 2 7 and 1. When we are in the Phrygian mode, we hear that 1 flat 2 7 motif. Yeah. That's all over this film, just kind of playing in the background. We also hear these really heavy 1 and flat 2 in the bass, which gives our ears discomfort. And you don't even know that it's happening because when a 1 and flat 2 are played in really, really low frequencies, they're even closer together than if, okay, 1 and flat 2 are played in really high frequencies, just because of the physics of sound. So when something's really, really close and not exactly the same, it gives us this vibration, like, in your body. Yeah, exactly. So it's playing, okay, with that. It's the same thing that we hear in Terminator 1984. Same kind of thing.
It's unsettling, yeah, yeah.
When we move over to the Aeolian tonality, which we hear a lot, this is tying in cyberpunk and industrial music. The Aeolian that we hear all the time in this movie, 5 flat 6 5 1.
Actually a reminder that in the third of these movies, because they made three, there's a Tetsuo the Iron Man. I think the next one is, it's got Hammer in the title. The third one is Tetsuo the Bullet Man, and Trent Reznor did a theme for that movie, which he also, I mean, you played it on the piano for me, and it's
Something I Can Never Have.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I fucking love that song.
Right. So when we're thinking about hardcore music, we hear that tritone and you can instantly aurally put that in place. Now, when listeners will hear that Aeolian or that Phrygian mode, you're going to think cyberpunk and you're going to think industrial music. And when you listen to this stuff, you're going to start to really hear it. Now, I'm not talking about pop industrial music. I'm not talking about like Orgy or something like that. I'm talking about Nine Inch Nails at the poppiest and then below that. You'll also hear it in any 20th century high art music. That's industrial. These modes really come from church modes.
Really?
Aeolian and Phrygian are old church modes.
Okay. Do you think it's, I mean, you mentioned how Japan sort of outlawed Christianity for a period of time, but were there like lingering elements of that where they'd sort of hold on to musical elements?
Japanese music's really interesting, and I'm certainly no expert on any Eastern kind of music. It's just not what I spend my time sitting around listening to. It's interesting because I would say this music in this case, using the Aeolian and the Phrygian, is really influenced by people like, maybe like Bauhaus or something like that.
Okay, so this is
Stockhausen.
Sort of coming into the mindset of like, you know, cyberpunk, industrial, Japanese new wave, if you will.
Right.
But, okay, so this is, its origins aren't in Japan.
Right.
Okay.
And remember when I said this is really tied into Dadaism?
Mm-hmm.
Duchamp also wrote some music I'm talking 1911, really? 1912. Wrote some music, and it is the crunchiest stuff you've ever heard. And someone really cool to listen to is Antonio Russolo's composition, and it's a 1921 composition. It's a march, but it's got all this crunchy texture behind it. 1921 is getting you that industrial sound. Duchamp mostly played with language and the idea of language making beats and cacophony. Okay. And so there's not a whole lot, because everyone associates... When you think of industrial, you think of this kind of avant-garde music, even Dadaism, you think of John Cage. And that's where you stop and you say, this must have just started with John Cage, but they were doing it in 1912,
1911. That's really cool. That lends a really cool angle that I hadn't considered.
It's better now, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't ultimately have a problem with this movie overall, but that certainly makes me like it more.
It made me appreciate it a lot more, right?
Yeah. That, like, on all fronts, the visuals are some, you know, especially for 1988, like some next level shit. And to find out that the music has a lot more depth than is sort of apparent on the surface. Yeah, pretty cool. And yeah, I don't know. I was thinking watching it, as far as like today's modern aesthetic, like, people are implementing technology into their skin. Like, there's a whole wave of like body modification where people are implementing technology subdermally, even making this movie feel almost prescient. But I think that it almost served as a warning, as far as, like, you know, people's relationship with technology. And, you know, it sort of does work on the metaphor level of, like, it is this curse where eventually it's sprouting from the inside of this guy.
Right.
Yeah,
I think it's funny, too, when you think about the history of cyberpunk films, or when they kind of come about, when you see quite a great deal, and you have Blade Runner, then you have something like this. But even you have Metropolis, which is a cyberpunk kind of ideal, that the machines and this is very bad.
Of the same era where,
of Dadaism, exactly.
Duchamp is making his, like, weird vocal overlaying music.
Right.
And,
and we see the Terminator. So in the 80s, it was just a huge kind of thing on people's minds. And then you go into the 90s and see The Matrix, Johnny Mnemonic. And so it comes about, you know how zombies have their day and then they kind of, like, go back off for a little bit? Yeah. Cyberpunk horror is also something that you see.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a whole new trend, considering, I mean, how long before, like, Google Glass is a contact lens, and there is no line between technology and us.
Right.
And the movie kind of plays with that idea, like, just how much technology can one implement before you lose your humanity. Yeah, I don't know. That's all I got on Tattoo of the Iron Man.
Yeah.
I think I don't know that I enjoyed talking about the movies as much as I did watching them, but I don't know.
I enjoyed talking about them more than I enjoyed watching them.
I got that feeling. Especially when it comes to the music, certainly. Yeah, but so that'll do it for this first part episode on J-horror. Our first, I think these are the first films, like, of Japanese origin that we've covered on the show.
No, because that's not true. We've talked about Rape Zombie.
We did talk about Rape Zombie. You're right. I forgot about that. That was a lunch hour review.
The only other film we've talked about is Rape Zombie. Oh, God.
Shame on us.
Oh, jeez.
But not shame on us. Throw praise in our direction on iTunes and Google Play Music, wherever you find the podcast. It would be a huge help to drop us a review. You don't have to name check this episode if you don't want. But yeah, it goes a long way in helping us grow the podcast. And you can also find us on our website, therantsmacabre.com. where we kind of use it as a hub where you can listen to the show and also see all the visuals and video stuff that we've produced. We're also on Patreon, where you can find an independent catalog of stuff that you don't normally get on this podcast feed. For $1 a month, you get access to all those shows, sketches, music, commentary, and more to come.
As always, we are on social media. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Rants Macabre.
And Instagram.
I always forget about Instagram. I always forget
Can't
about
forget
that.
The gram.
Dang. IG.
I had to ask you what IG was at one point. I just assumed the abbreviation would be like Insta, but no,
That's too many letters. No one has time for that. We just talked about cyberpunk. No one has time for that.
This is certainly a genre that's got its devoted fans. So we're curious to hear your recommendations. We're never going to get all of the Japanese made horror, but we'd love to hear your info. You could contact us at therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And yeah, we love hearing from you guys. So drop us a line. That'll do it for me. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.